no preferences for the Aboriginal population. Did you have another question?
Yes, just a follow-up to that. I honestly didn't know what the answer to that was going to be, and the next question is in the context of the experience that we're having in the Northwest Territories right now with the development of self-government. One of the problems right now is that Native people, I don't know, I'll leave the Eastern Territory to those people over there, but on the Western half, there's a certain school of thought that says the Native people are in the majority there, and therefore, you know, we can be in a control position. But I think our answer to that is that we expect somewhere down the road that there is going to be more and more immigration from southern Canada, and we will eventually become a minority there, and therefore we need some special provisions for our people. And I'm wondering, is that a concern for you in Greenland?
Yes, I suppose if Lars Emil Johansen then succeeded in having passed Land Ownership Act, it would be with preference for original population in Greenland. I think that in the Greenlandic policy, we sometimes forget the future situation. If the question of exploitation about Scoresby Sund in East Greenland should be continue to end and result in exploitation, I suppose that the possibilities you mentioned would require an open eyes of politicians, because there are population about 400 persons, isolated population, and if there came about 1,500 miners and oil people from outside and have the same rights in connection with elections, I suppose that the original culture and original tradition would be disturbed very, very strongly and maybe disappear.
Don Mitchell, you had a question. Oops.
Thank you. I actually had two questions, one of which actually turned out to be the last one. So I've spared everyone one question. One of the things that I was struck by when I was listening to your presentation and trying to apply it to Alaska was the issue of political sovereignty versus economic sovereignty. And at least based upon what I thought I heard you say, at the moment, essentially, you have a geographical area in which indigenous people are in the political majority and exercise certain political rights, at the same time that the budget of the institution you've established to express those political rights, your home rule government, is really dependent, at least for half of its wealth, on the largesse of the folks that came over there to have their way with you some time ago to begin with. You mentioned, what I was struck by was you mentioned that your politicians seem to know how far they can go, and therefore there has not been a conflict between the Danish government and your home rule government. And I guess my question after saying all of that is that really sovereignty? If in fact you know what those other people want you to do and you act in that fashion because you're obviously dependent upon them to run your schools and your hospitals and everything else, are you really exercising authentic self-government?
I think that it is possible to live this condition for some time, but I think that is inevitable, that there may come interest conflicts, and in this situation the Greenlandic politician will be very weak towards the Danish ones. In fact, we have experienced some interest conflicts also in connection with Home Rule Commission work, this just the question of land ownership that resulted in non-defined formulation that helped in this way that negotiation could continue. And I suppose that there were nothing effect beyond this. I think that question of mineral exploitation in Greenland, it was done this way that possibilities are examined, but at least the mineral administration, it tried to drive the questions rather slow, so many things are examined before license are given. But the sense of the negotiation about things is to me a key to get Greenland independent of Danish financial support, and maybe also turn the stream of financial support the other way.
I have thought up one additional question, and that is sort of continuing that thought through a bit. As I understand what you said earlier, at the moment there is sort of a dual agreement with respect to development decisions between the Home Rule government and the Danish government. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. What is the relationship of smaller units of your government to those decisions? In other words, if the Home Rule government and the Danish government agreed to develop a non-renewable resource in the area of a local community, how does that local community, if they don't like that decision, or if they like that decision but want it to be done and implemented in a particular way, how do they fit into that decision-making process, if at all?
We have not very experiences in this connection. In connection with mining nearby Umanna, West Greenland, the municipality was interested in having a mine in this area, while the closest settlements were reluctant to accept it, but had not clear idea about it. In connection with offshore drillings in the 70s, at least Siumut and most of the provincial council was against it, but they were begun after some drillings. They were stopped because the layers were too young to give some hope of finding something. And it was a good example, but it was from before home rule situation. Now have we in East Greenland the plans of oil exploration. And in this condition is the local community to clearly against this 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 it is not clearly against this exploration, while it demanded very clearly that it should this should avoid using the Scoresby and fjord itself as supply harbor, and use fjords on the north side of Jameson Land for this purpose. There no decision about this, but there is a minority in the community itself that was against the exploration at all. But I suppose that even though if there was majority against it, this exploration would be done. It is my impression. There is not quite clear energy policy in Greenland, and this onshore drilling, it was proposed by some Greenlandic politicians in the 70s, since I think it was a hope that they in this way should avoid more offshore drilling in West Coast. It was a kind of something for something.
Peter Atinwar and Shorty O'Neill and David Case. Peter, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Peterson, we in the Eastern Arctic of Canada are trying to develop a language policy for the new territory we're proposing. We'd like to hear about Greenland's language policy. We hear it's a comprehensive one. As well, I have a second question unrelated to the first one. How much money does the Greenland Home Rule government have under its control?
Excuse me?
How much money does the Greenland Home Rule government have under its control
each year? Yes. Concerning the first question, the new Greenland Education Act from 1979, it states that Greenlandic language is the first language in Greenland, also in the school, and the position of Greenlandic as subject and as instructional language has been strengthened very much. I think that it has also connection with the reform of orthography in the 70s. I think that Greenlandic language is rather strong also today. And in 1982, the Greenland Home Rule Language Committee was changed to, no, Language Commission was changed to Language Committee with the right to authorize some new expressions, new terms, and also with the possibility to elaborate Greenlandic terms in school subjects. I think it is the most important thing about it. While introduction of TV, I think that has given somewhat weaker position for the Greenlandic language. In radio, there are beyond the music transmissions, about 80% of transmission with Greenlandic language. And Greenlandic church has traditionally used Inuit language in services, announcements, and its textbooks. And they are, in this way, some different institution where Greenlandic language is rather strong.
Before you move on to Mr. Atinwar's second question, what is the official language spoken in the parliament of Greenland, the Home Rule Parliament?
They speak the Greenlandic language. There is one Danish non-Greenlandic speaking member, and in this connection all speeches are translated into Danish.
There was a second question. How much money is really available to be spent by the Greenland Home Rule government each year? That
yes, there is an amount about 1 billion that is originated from Greenlandic sources today. Was it a question? Was it an answer?
Dennis Patterson.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just add a supplementary to that. I'm just sort of interested in a loose comparison between the Northwest Territories and Greenland, because we have approximately the same population, and I know there are not many points of comparison, but what would the operating budget be? I don't mean the Greenland government's revenues, but what money, what is the total of the Greenland Home Rule's budget, including sources from Denmark?
Yes, it is about 1,900,000, and it is 2 billions, but about 100 million are from EAC's funds for developing regions.
You're speaking of Danish kroner.
Yes.
And that would be about 5 to an American dollar, would it?
About 10.
About 10?
Yes.
Right. Wow. I think Shorty O'Neill and then David Case.
Dr. Peterson, we know that, well, we've heard this afternoon that the indigenous people of Greenland are in a majority, but you have a very loose type of government arrangement with Denmark. I want to go on into the South Pacific for a bit, put up some of the experiences there. And East Timor at the present time, Indonesia is waging a genocidal war and shipping in many Indonesian people. And, you know, 8 years ago, the East Timorese people were the 95% of the population of East Timor. Today, they're something like 20%. In West Papua, the same type of genocidal action is carried on, except that the Indonesians are immigrating the prostitutes from Indonesia and making a law that they must marry into the Melanesian race so that they breed the race out. We can go further down into New Caledonia and Tahiti and France's involvement in that, where they've opened up invitations to expatriates from newly independent countries to come in and flood the countries. 20 years ago, the Kanak people of New Caledonia was something like 85% majority. Today, they're just touching on a 50% of the population. And if France's actions continue to happen, then in a few years' time, they're going to become a minority in their own country, and independence, unless they get it within the next 12 months, will probably be lost to them. Probably there's two questions on this. One is, if that type of action happened from the Danish government, do you think that's possible? And if you think it is possible, what would the Home Rule government do about that?
At least in the early contact with Europeans, there has been diseases who maybe took about two-thirds of the population. And after this, there has been severe the tuberculosis hit the population very hard, and average lifetime was about 33 years for the Greenlandic population. I suppose that after the different campaigns and organization of health service, at least this kind of problems are more or less passed in Greenland, while in connection with possible industrial and mining development in Greenland, there may come people from outside, especially specialists in a different kind of mining technology. I think as long as Greenland was a member of ECC, the Danish government had little possibility to have any control of migration from outside, because there is free mobility of occupation within ESC. This situation was observed in Greenland several times, because there are in the recent years increasing occupancy problems. It is a rather recent problem in Greenland, because fishing and hunting were earlier natural alternatives, but no more. In this connection, the Greenland Home Rule government made an act that was accepted by Denmark and by ESC, namely that there is the ESC free mobility of job searching person is limited in Greenland, and there should be sent a special application for job immigrants, as long as there are occupational problems in Greenland. In this way, I think that it seems to be that at least some of the problem would be solved by negotiation, international negotiations, via Danish government. But maybe it is also a question how tempting the Greenlandic mineral resources are for the industrial countries. It is difficult to evaluate, but I think the conditions are somewhat better than one should expect.
Case, you had a question.
Mike, at the risk of sort of asking the same question for the third time, maybe, I have the same question that Rick Hardy and Shorty O'Neill had, but I'd like to just focus on one aspect of it. Don Wright, when he was here last week, 2 weeks ago, said that one of the biggest mistakes that the Native Americans made was to adopt poor immigration laws. And so I just would like to ask, who makes the immigration laws in Greenland? And what are they? Is there a simple way to talk about that, or do we have to discuss the relationship with Denmark?
Normally, immigration laws will be made by the Danish Parliament, but there is a special concerning job immigration that was passed by the Greenlandic Parliament and accepted it, not adopted, accepted by the Danish government.
And will Greenland's absenting itself from the EEC, will that have any effect on the job mobility question for the EEC, or is that part of the negotiations whereby you got out of the or will get out of the EEC?
Yes, I think it has connection with that there is little immigration from Greenland outside Denmark. There has been youth immigration to Denmark in connection with employment problems in Greenland for some years, and it creates some Greenlandic non-employment problems in Denmark. It is a question that is rather difficult to solve, because these persons have also readaptation problems when they got back to Greenland. But in connection with the Greenland economy, there is very little interest to fish outside Greenland till now. And there is also interest, little interest, in searching jobs outside Denmark or Greenland. But the situation may change, of course.
I think that it's clear that Greenland being a part of the realm of Denmark, there is complete freedom of movement between Denmark and Greenland. So that there are no curbs on the possibilities of immigration from Denmark. Well, I think that we've exhausted Dr. Peterson, if not ourselves. And I think that we might now move on. There's a little bit of time left, and if Mark Gordon is willing to begin, perhaps we could do that. Mark Gordon is Vice President of Makovic, one of the corporations established under the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement of 1975. And that was the second important land claim settlement in the modern era after Alaska in 1971. And I think, as Mark will tell us, the Inuit and the Cree of Northern Quebec looked very closely at the Alaskan model and adopted some provisions, rejected others, and I think he will tell us as well what lessons they have learned, and that may take us beyond the time of adjournment tonight, so we'll give you more time in the morning, Mark, but would you begin now then?
Okay, since time doesn't allow it, I think I'll try to skip over the first 6,000 years of history and start about the end of World War II. There was the governments had had intense interest in the Inuit before the end of World War II. It was only after the American bases were set up, the dew line stations, and that had been set up. And also, there was also a period of starvation that our people are going through because the Hudson Bay Company had over-harvested the whale stocks and the seals in most of the eastern Arctic areas, and this caused a drastic decline of food resources for the people. And there was also, in particular in the northern Quebec area, there was also the crash of the caribou population, which made the problem worse. And on top of this, there was the introduction of the what are referred to as common diseases, such as measles, the common cold, that took a heavy toll on our population. And because the situation was so bad, the government then realized it had to do something with these people. And had to try and help them out. The Hudson Bay had been administering welfare because the people that they had been trading with for the last couple hundred years were suddenly just dying off. And so they couldn't just leave them there to starve, so they were emptying their warehouses and giving it out to the people that were coming to them for help. So the Hudson Bay Company requested that the government of Quebec pay for this food that they had given away. The Quebec government rejected this and said that the federal government should pay for it. And then the federal and provincial governments went into a long court battle to try and determine whether we should be covered under provincial jurisdiction or federal jurisdiction as like the Indians. In this instance, the Quebec government won its case. It's been, I don't know if, I think they've had second thoughts about whether they won or lost, but initially they won the case and the federal government had to pay the bills. So this put us under federal jurisdiction as wards of the state, or the federal government had this trustee relationship with us after that point on. Since this had happened, the federal government then sent up federal government agents through these agents started administering welfare and also brought in health services and education. Situation brought made the people start gravitating around where the services were available, where they could get some medicine, where they could get food. And but the people were still basically living out in their traditional areas still at that time, and scattered quite sparsely over the territory. The one thing that they started to do was that if people wanted to get assistance from the government, one of the conditions for that assistance was that the children had to be educated in the federal education systems. And since the families didn't want to break up, this also put more pressure on the people to live around these administrative centers. And then thus the villages were created. So this is basically the context in which the federal government became interested in us. The Quebec government came into the scene quite a bit later, as far as we were concerned. They had been given the lands had been transferred to the Quebec government, but they had not had any presence in our territory. Legally, the territory was under Quebec jurisdiction, but the Quebec government presence was non-existent. It was not until about 1962 when René Lévesque, when he was at then, that time he was the Minister for Natural Resources, came up to our villages. He wanted to talk about the Quebec government's role in the territory, and he was challenged by one of the delegates that if you say that this is Quebec lands, why don't you at least build one outhouse up here so that we can see your presence? Unfortunately, he took it seriously and began to put Quebec government agents in every community. And then we used to have a joke about these Quebec government agents. We would say that they sent one man there to hold the flag. And because this one man holding the flag had to bring his family, they then had to bring in a carpenter to build his house. But the carpenter could not go around without a vehicle. So they brought him a vehicle who needed a mechanic. Then when the mechanic was there, then they needed a paymaster. And then we had this big establishment, basically all servicing one man holding the flag. All the services basically at that time were still being administered directly by the federal government, education, welfare, and all this. So then the Quebec government slowly started taking over some of the services, the administration of welfare. They then introduced their own competing system for education, for health, and other related services. It came to a point where it was quite interesting. The governments were competing for our attention, it seemed, but doing a very bad job of it, both of them. Neither of them could make a big commitment financially because they were afraid that the native people's support would shift to the other government. To give you an indication of how bad the situation got to one point, they would have two nursing stations in some of our villages. And the two nursing stations were competing for the patients. So they couldn't transfer medical records from one nursing station down the street to the other one. So when one of them went on the holidays, if you happened to be, let's say, been going to the Quebec nursing station, and the nurse went on holidays and you go to the federal one, they had no medical records to assess your case. They then went into their own diagnosis of your problem and gave you the medications as to what they thought it was. In fact, they wouldn't even write what the medicine was on the boxes, so that if the Inuk should go to the other nursing station, they couldn't find out what it was that they were being given. This was one of the ridiculousness of the situation at a point. Where land claims started to move in, and we didn't call it land claims then. We had no perception, no idea what land claims was. That's what the lawyers told us that we were doing. We didn't know that. We didn't realize that. What all we were doing was that we heard that there was going to be a big hydro project south of us, quite a distance south of us. Actually, the project itself is more in the Cree territory than ours. But the impacts were going to be felt in our area. The flow of the rivers were going to be reduced, and they were going to be building major dams. And they were going to flood some 4,000 square miles of land, the world's biggest hydroelectric project. So with the native people were afraid of the impact it was going to have on their livelihood, the resources. And on this basis, they went into the court. Then that's when land claims started coming around, and we didn't understand that we were going into land claims. It was only a way to beat this project. We were told that the boundaries had been extended in 1912.
The boundaries of the province.
The boundaries were extended northward. And in fact, at that time, they had such lousy maps, they didn't realize that there was all these islands you could throw a rock to that are now in the Northwest Territories, because they just simply said in the legislation, this shall go up to the high water mark or low water mark. They're still fighting over that. But they would just extend the boundary outwards to the ocean. And so in this Boundaries Extension Act, there was one clause in it that said they had to settle the native interest to this area. And on that basis, we won a court injunction with the court injunction to stop the James Bay project. This victory was very short-lived. It only lasted a week. What they got us in another way. They got us through what they call the balance of inconvenience, which means if there's more of them being affected adversely than us, they win, regardless of whether who's right. So so we then ended up, the project was back on stream, and now the whole notion of land claim started to sink in to us. Stopping the project didn't work, but then we realized that the situation in which governmental services were being provided for us was a complete mess, and we wanted to try and rationalize this. And also, because of the project and the encroachment that was going to be coming up of the different developments that were starting to come into our territory around that time, there was an asbestos mine that was already in operation. There was a possibility of two other mines being opened up in our area. So the question of land ownership became a very keen interest at that time, because we realized that we weren't going to get any benefits from these big projects, and we would basically pay the price in terms of losing our resources and the damages to the environment and possibly social impacts on our society. Then since we ended up in this situation, we didn't know anything about land claims. We decided we better go and check out what happened in Alaska, because this was one of the arguments that was used in the court case. And it was the only other example we could turn to. By that time, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was in place and beginning to operate. The process of land selection and all this was happening on this side of the globe. And so we sent a very small delegation, because we had no money really in those days anyway. A very small delegation to go up and find out what they could about the Native Claims Settlement Act here. And we got some very good advice from the people around here. We went and saw the people in the North Slope area and also around, I believe they call it the Nana region now, Northwest Alaska. And also talked to the State Federation of Natives here. And they gave us some good advice, and we tried to follow up on that advice when we got into our own claims negotiations. There were some things that they said that were obviously missing in their own claim at that time. The assessments had already started. Their own internal assessments had started at that time. We were told that the whole question of hunting rights was completely lacking, and that if we were going to settle a land claims, we should at least include that element in it. The whole procedure of the question of how the land selections was done here, the checkerboard fashion in which the land selections was here, was something that they felt was not desirable, and that we should go for another scheme, another way of selecting the lands. All this we took into consideration and tried to see what we could do. There was also some other things that we had noticed about the Alaska Native corporations themselves. In our land claims, we were supposed to get a certain amount of land and also the compensation for past damages. And with this compensation, we were going to do what they had done here in Alaska, and we were going to set up a regional corporation. This regional corporation was to administer the funds for the benefit of the people. The reason we didn't go for giving out the money to individuals was that we felt that that way the benefit of that compensation would dissipate and disappear in a matter of a couple years. Despite the poverty and poor living conditions we were under, we thought that by centralizing it, it will give us a better weapon, a better means to be able to deal with Western economic systems. The corporate structure that had been adopted here was not what we wanted. We noticed that the beneficiaries of your claim settlement was only limited to the number of people that happened to be around at that time. So people that were born after were not going to be able to benefit directly in this. So this presented us a problem, and we had to, when we came to trying to design a corporation, we wanted to get around this problem. So what we did was we set up a membership corporation where if you are an Inuk and you are enrolled and you become a beneficiary of the agreement, then your descendants automatically become beneficiaries or shareholders of this corporation as well. Here in Alaska, I understand that you can sell your shares after a certain period of time. Now, we thought that was contrary to what the compensation was supposed to do. The compensation was supposed to go to the native people for the damages that they had suffered. It wasn't something that you should be able to sell off and end up with your native corporation basically being owned by outsiders again, which was very easy and financially tempting if you could do that. So we made it impossible to sell your shares. And you can't will your share to anybody. Your descendants will automatically become members of the corporation and do not... the rules in the corporation so that... a limited few would not take all the benefits and run. We made it so that if there is to be any benefit given, it could not be given to an individual. It could not be given to an individual as distinct from the community. So if you were going to give something to your people, you had to make the offer to all of your people. These are some of the basic principles that we began to adopt. There was another thing that we had been told was that in the corporation structures here, the financial controls or the financial requirements were pretty free, very free money. It was very easy to spend that money. So we were afraid what would happen is that we didn't have very many educated people. In fact, you could probably count them on one hand, even today. So what we decided was that we would put investment restrictions on the corporation. And the restrictions that we adopted were much like the ones used by insurance companies, which have to have large amounts of capital over long periods of time. So we set up the restrictions so that they would be very restrictive at the beginning when we don't know it. We have no experience. Nobody had millions of dollars. So we didn't know how to administer this kind of money, and we knew that there was going to be a learning stage we would have to go through. So we made it very, very restrictive at the beginning. 75% of the funds had to be in blue chip investments. The 25% of it could be used for venture capital, and the interest from the total amount of funds could be also used towards venture capital investments. What we did was after a certain time period, I think it's 20 years, what will happen is that 50% of the funds will then be available for venture capital. And then beyond that, we incorporated in our bylaws that $30 million will always be tied up in blue chip funds. The interest from that could be used for venture capital investments. This all this was done on the advice of and the experience of the people in, here in Alaska. The corporation that we had set up was it didn't quite fit into any of the corporate laws in Canada, so it had to be created by a special legislation of the Quebec Parliament. Now, in terms of the James, we also had other elements that were included. The notion of hunting rights was also included into our agreement. The land areas, we went for ownership as opposed to what was accepted practice in Canada, which was lands were held in reserve by the governments. The reason we didn't quite like this approach was that the lands, if you wanted to do something with your lands, you always had to turn around and ask the government permission to do what you want to do. So we opted for ownership, but protected ownership. And the lands are not held by the regional corporation. The lands are held by the at the community level by what we call the landholding corporations. Each village has a landholding corporation that has the rights to administer the lands. And there's no corporate link other than a moral one between the landholding corporation and our regional one.
Are the landholding corporations membership corporations?
Yes, they are set up. They're membership corporations, and the same type of requirements are as the regional corporation were used. Now that's one aspect of the claims negotiations. Where our claims negotiations differed was that we also, rightly or wrongly, had to negotiate for public services that we should have been able to receive and should have been able to control as citizens of the province or of the country. To give you an example, in the area of education, before the James Bay Agreement, as I said, there was two systems. Under the federal system, we had no say at all in the education system. The Quebec government was, they do things more symbolically. What they did was they allowed us to have parents' committees in each village. They gave them authority over two things. That was to hire and fire the janitor, and to hire and fire the person that picked up the kindergarten kids by skidoo each morning. That was the limit of the authority we had over education. So we then had to expend a lot of our negotiating strength and do a lot of trade-offs for basic services that we should have received as citizens of that country. Education is one area that we worked on. Health was another area. We set up hospital corporations and a health board. The other element was the Kennewick Regional Government was set up through this, and this was the form of self-government that we wanted to go for. It's a non-ethnic government, much like your borough systems here, and in fact modeled quite a lot after that, but there are some differences because of the way the laws operate in Canada, I mean in Quebec in particular. The Kennewick Regional Government was something that the people really wanted to strive for. In fact, when we used to have our meetings with the villages, we used to have, they used to always leave the Development Corporation and the compensation funds till the very last thing to talk about. Almost all the meetings were taken up talking about how this government was supposed to operate. Then here again, I would say that it's something we should have been able to attain simply as citizens of the province. It's something that we shouldn't have had to trade off in a claims negotiation. We shouldn't have had to do that, but there was no other alternative for us. Now, the Kativik Regional Government is, what it did was we set up each municipality, each village as a municipality. And then each of the municipalities have a representative in a regional council. The regional council can make minimum standards for all of the other villages, for all the villages, and also it's a central place where they work out their priorities on what has to be developed, how is the housing allocation is going to be distributed through the communities, these types of things. Now, the regional government, in theory and in the agreement, if you read through it, it would appear to have a great deal of power, more so than most municipalities elsewhere in Canada. But where the failing is that the government funds the regional government program,
Quebec.
Well, it's there's funding arrangements are different for each program as well. Some of them are jointly funded by the federal and provincial government. Some of them are funded exclusively by the Quebec government. Well, that's what they say, but they actually get their funds from the feds, we know. Like housing, the housing, we get our housing funds from Quebec Housing Corporation, who gets half their funds from the federal government, but they say this is exclusively Quebec money we're getting. The funding is done by program, they're earmarked by program. And so here is where the autonomy is lost. They can dictate almost exactly what you can do or what you're allowed to do by this financial control. We have no discretionary funds. We don't have enough of a tax base at this time to be able to raise our own funds. So everything is done based on subsidies coming in from the south. So here they have the control by having to apply to each program for the funds, and then you got to follow all the rules and regulations. This is something that we've been trying to overcome over the last few years, and it didn't seem like there was going to be a much chance of changing it, even though the James Bay Agreement is supposed to be amendable if both parties agree. But in recent years, when the constitutional discussions were on, we managed to be able to start up a process with the Quebec government where we were going to, again, start negotiating exactly how this regional government is going to gain more autonomy. One of the approaches that we had decided to adopt was the one that had been used in Greenland, which even though they received great deals amount of subsidies from the Danish parliament, they receive it in block amounts over a given period of time. So this approach seems to be the one that we would like to take. It would give us the opportunity to decide where our spending priorities will be, and will give us also the assurance that programs will be funded year after year over a five-year period. You see, in our political battles with the Quebec government over things like language rights, separation from the country, the small matters, we always ended up in the opposite position of our Quebec government. And by doing so, they become very reluctant to give you housing grants and funding for municipal services. If you go against them on their major policies, They're not going to be very forthcoming with their funds. But we couldn't, the political stance we had to make were, we felt, were for our own survival, and we had to pay the price for it. The language legislation in Quebec is something that we fought very hard for and eventually got an exemption for it.
I think that we have to adjourn now. I think you've got everybody's attention, especially the people from Alaska. And because we really did promise we would give the hall up at 4:45, we must adjourn. But I think everybody's eager to have you continue in the morning. And indeed, we shall continue at 9 a.m.